Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kudelska. There's been a lot of questions about how journalism is doing in the past couple of weeks. So we sat down for a roundtable about the state of journalism in Wyoming.
It did sort of reinforce the vulnerabilities that we knew about in our ecosystem.
Thanks to lawmakers, Wyomingites have seen their property taxes shrink, but it could cost some small towns.
If we have no means of getting any savings, then, you know, we have to go out and borrow.
And Wyoming is the fossil fuel state, but rooftop solar has managed to carve out a niche market.
The idea really plays that, like, hey, we grow our own food, we hunt for our own meat, let's produce our own power.
What will it look like now that Congress is rolling back federal incentives? Those stories and more, stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we cut through the distracting clutter in the week's news and get to what really matters.
It's sweet, but can we talk about the nipple rings?
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we take the shirt off the news and see what's under there every week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 and Sunday afternoon at 4 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Wyoming Public Media is providing Wyoming and Western wildfire updates on air and now online. Go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Wyoming Wildfire Info. You'll find links to the latest updates on fires around the region, along with information on current air quality conditions, fire restrictions, information on protecting your property, and more. Find it all in one place at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kudelska. A couple of weeks ago, a media company that owned dozens of newspapers across the region suddenly collapsed. It forced 8 Wyoming papers to shut down. The outcry statewide was immediate, but a week later, the owners of the Buffalo Bulletin stepped forward with one other investor and offered to buy all 8 and keep them publishing. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with Rob Hicks and Jen Steve Hicks to hear how they decided to buy these Wyoming papers.
To start with, I wonder if you can tell me how you found out that News Media Corporation was going to be shutting down all these papers and what your initial reaction was.
We found out that these publications were closing the same way that the staff found out, the same way that the rest of the state found out, with an announcement on Facebook.
I felt so bad for the communities. I know what it's like to live in a small community. And my first thought, I was like, oh my gosh, school's starting in 2 weeks. And all those school things that nobody is going to document, that first home football game, there's not going to be anyone there to take a picture or write a story. And that might seem small, but for the participants and the parents and the grandparents, it's not small. And my second thought, like in the same moment, was who's going to cover their government meetings? Who is going to be the government watchdog? And how are we going to get those public notices published?
What kind of conversations started happening behind the scenes with you and any of the news organizations that you were in contact with?
The conversations with our colleagues throughout the state were, gee, I hope someone picks up the baton. I think the suddenness with which this happened was really the jaw dropper on all of this. You can see our faces on the screen. We're not young. We're not new to this industry. I don't think either of us had this on our plan for 2025.
What really happened is we started getting phone calls around the state from retired publishers, retired editors, lamenting this and saying, you know, what's going to happen here? You know, there just didn't seem to be any good answers. You know, sometimes when there's not an answer, you have to be the one to step up and answer that call. And so I talked to Jen about this, and I said, I think I'm going to call Rob Mortimer and find out what's going on.
Can you tell us who Rob Mortimer is for those folks who don't know?
Rob Mortimer was the former publisher of the Torrington Telegram and really the publisher of the entire Wyoming group. He's been with news media for over 20 years. He was born and raised in Torrington, Wyoming.
What was his response when you called?
All of this happened 7 days ago. So he was still, I think, a little shell-shocked about what happened because he didn't get advanced notice either. And he was in a process of saying, you know, I'm just scrambling, trying to put something together. There may be people that want to buy bits and pieces of it, but that doesn't guarantee all of the publications. I said, well, you know, what would it take to get all of them? And he said, I don't know. Let me call J.J. Tompkins, who's the CEO of News Media Corp. And Rob called me back and he said, you know, I think ballpark, it's this. I then called our banking partner, First Northern Bank, and spoke with their president, Travis Lohr. Said, what's this going to take? And he said, Rob, we'll do what it takes to get it done. And so if this goes through, we'll be borrowing against the Buffalo Bulletin. When I got that positive response, I called Rob Mortimer back and I said, hey, I think that we can get this together. Are you willing to invest too? And he said, absolutely.
You both have, you know, Wyoming roots. You guys have been here at least running the paper since 1996. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about why it is important to have our Wyoming papers being managed and run by people from here.
I think fundamentally, a community newspaper should both lead and reflect its community. So when people pick up the Buffalo Bulletin today, when it comes back from being printed and it's for sale in grocery stores, in convenience stores, I want them to see a lifestyle and people who are familiar to them. That's really important to me. I also think it's important for the newspaper to lead. Sometimes that means uncomfortable reporting on uncomfortable things or uncomfortable conversations. That can be really hard in a small town because these are people you're going to see at your kid's soccer game on the sidelines, or you're going to see them at church on Sunday. But I think it's the job of the newspaper to hold up the mirror to the community, but also to lead discussions in the community, good or bad. I'm in the newsroom all week long, and not a single week passes that I don't get a phone call or an email from someone looking for something that was published in the Buffalo Bulletin at some point, you know, since 1884. That makes me really cognizant of the fact that we are our community's scrapbook. This is the history that's been written down about Johnson County, Wyoming. And if it weren't for the Buffalo Bulletin, that history wouldn't get written down, period.
My grandfather came to Buffalo in 1956 and worked as an editor. He bought the paper in 1960. My dad bought that from him in 1964, my dad and Jack Williams. Well, in 1993, I came to Newcastle, Wyoming, and bought the Newcastle Newsletter Journal. I operated that for 3 years, and then my folks called me and said, how'd you like to buy a newspaper? And so in 96, I moved back. I married Jen in 2005, and she started working as a part-time reporter. Eventually, that became a full-time reporter, and eventually that became the most award-winning editor we've ever had. I know that we matter. And oftentimes, people don't know what they have until they lose it. And I think these communities got to experience a little bit of that. If Jen and Rob Hicks and Rob Mortimer from Podunk, Wyoming, can go and buy 8 newspapers that were closing and make them viable and vibrant again, that people will take that lesson and say, why can't this be replicated everywhere? Our belief in the importance of news and our belief in the staffs of these newspapers, if that can work and be successful, I think that maybe we create a new national narrative that newspapers aren't dying.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with Buffalo Bulletin publishers Rob Hicks and Jen Sieve Hicks. Stay tuned. We are going to circle back later in the show and hear from a roundtable of news media folks to discuss how this shakeup has affected the threat of potential news deserts in Wyoming. Right now, if you want rooftop solar on your home, the federal government will pay for about a third of the cost. But that's going away because the One Big Beautiful Bill is now law. Companies that do that solar work are worried about what their future looks like. But in Wyoming, they're a little more hopeful. Political headwinds are nothing new in the fossil fuel state. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan has this story.
I'm climbing the utility stairs of the Albany County Courthouse.
Oh, wow, look at this.
I pop onto the roof where there's several rows of glistening black solar panels.
So they're angled a little bit so they can get the best production. It's facing due south.
Electrician Andrew Weatherford installed them over the last couple weeks. Weatherford is in his 30s and loves exploring Wyoming, so this job is a good fit. It takes him across the state year round.
You know, we're doing this when it's 100 degrees plus on some of these roofs in the summertime, and then, you know, when we're working and it's December, you know, you're clearing snow off roofs, 2 degrees, 0 degrees.
But today, Weatherford is unspooling electric cords. They'll run from the roof of the courthouse to a control box about 60 feet below.
To connect the power that's produced from the solar panels to the building.
This is a Creative Energies project. They're one of the few rooftop solar installation companies in Wyoming. Their headquarters are in Lander, where co-owner Scott Kane gives the tour.
We like to think of it as like the epicenter of solar energy for the state of Wyoming.
Kane takes us into a giant shop building lined with sunflowers. Inside, it's like a full-on hardware store. Tools, electrical and solar equipment, trucks, everything they need to service projects around the state. Kane says they built the shop a couple years ago.
We noticed, like, wow, there's been a lot of demand for solar, and we're having a hard time keeping up with the demand that's out there.
Partly because of a federal tax credit for residential rooftop solar. It was beefed up under the Biden administration, but it first came about under President George W. Bush. The Republicans' solar tax credit was supposed to taper down by 2008, but...
it's been extended because subsequent administrations saw that the program was working well.
But just this summer, Congress voted to completely phase out the 30% credit by the end of the year.
So that went from being, you know, almost a 20-year-long program to ending overnight. So that really feels like a scramble right now.
A scramble to squeeze the surge of customers who want that cheaper price tag.
We're almost at the point now where we need to start saying no to customers, that we can't get their project built before the end of the year.
Over half of Kane's customers are residential. It's unclear if they'll still want his services next year when prices go up. And as a business, that's unnerving.
Rather than continuing to add people and invest in vehicles and invest in new buildings, to more of a, like, let's sustain the business mindset.
Kane has faced headwinds before. He helped found Creative Energies in 2001 when Wyoming's fossil fuels were booming.
Some might say that a renewable energy company, you're operating in Wyoming, like that must be, feel like you're operating behind enemy lines.
But he found a niche market.
The idea really plays that, like, hey, we grow our own food, we hunt for our own meat, let's produce our own power.
So he hopes that mindset will continue. But commercial tax credits aren't ending for another couple years. So Kane wants to tap more into that market, like the Albany County Courthouse.
All right, you gonna do them one at a time now?
No, I bet you can probably get all of them.
Okay, keep going.
Electrician Andrew Weatherford feeds the cords to his work partner, Noah Rohrbacher.
That should be it, and we should be able to fire this system up and see what it's producing and see what it'll be able to do for the building.
Adding the courthouse to the more than 3,000 buildings with rooftop solar in Wyoming. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Laramie.
Up next, we check in with the Ranchester mayor to hear about how taxes are potentially impacting his community. This is Open Spaces.
Part of why I love Wyoming Public Radio is because it is probably the last remaining really truly valid radio format here in the U.S. because it still provides really valid content that you can't get anywhere else.
I love Wyoming Public Radio. It's just important.
Help celebrate I Love Wyoming Public Radio Week by clicking the I Love Wyoming Public Radio icon at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can access listener testimonials and find out how to record your own. Just look for I Love Wyoming Public Radio at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
It can be hard to keep track of the news, but Wyoming Public Radio just made it a little easier. Now you can follow us on Apple News to get the latest stories from Wyoming right in the palm of your hand. Plus, you can get an audio roundup of daily local news in under 10 minutes with our new podcast. Check out Wyoming Debrief, a morning habit that pairs perfectly with your cup of coffee.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Wyoming lawmakers have been targeting property taxes, more specifically cutting them, and there could be bigger cuts down the road. Next year, voters will decide whether to slash 50% of residential property taxes across the board. The revenue from these taxes funds special districts, towns, and counties, not the state. Already this year, they've felt the impact. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements spoke with Ranchester Mayor Peter Clark about how his small town of 1100 is faring.
Thanks so much for being here, Mayor Clark.
Thanks for asking me.
So paint a picture of Ranchester for our listeners who may not have been there before. What stands out to you about the community and the people?
It's really kind of a bedroom community of the city of Sheridan. We're about 15 miles northwest of that, about 9 miles south of the Montana border. We're growing considerably we've grown about 11% since 2020. So we're on a average growth rate of about 4% a year. So it's a lot of new people, a lot of new housing. We're at the foot of the Bighorn Mountains on the Tongue River.
Ranchester's budget has been going up in recent years as costs mount and more people move to the town. I read a report that it's one of the fastest growing towns in Wyoming, and I was just wondering, what's prompting that growth, would you say? And do you think that it will continue?
It looks like it's going to continue. What's prompting it? The big surge for us was probably COVID. We had a lot of people take flight from other parts of the country and land here. So that's driven a lot of the growth. We're also, the city of Sheridan is very expensive, so we've become a cheaper alternative.
During the last legislative session, lawmakers approved an across-the-board property tax cut. Single-family homeowners will now see a 25% cut applied to the first $1 million of their home's fair market value. What's the effect of these property tax cuts been on Ranchester's general fund, and how much revenue do you expect to lose?
Actually, that's a hard one to answer, because even though our property taxes have gone down, our population has increased, so we have a broader base of property taxes. So I got it from the assessor's office some time ago. It was about $13,000. For us, it's about 11% of our general fund, or 18% of our government net revenues that we get. So it's hard to predict because we keep getting more houses. So that's offsetting maybe the loss of the property tax. I guess my concern is that if they have this general attitude of cutting taxes, all taxes. That's, like I say, property taxes. We can withstand it. Counties have a little bit more, have more problem with that because they don't make up some of the losses by substituting fees for services that we can do.
But your best guess is around $13,000 to the general fund.
Yeah, something like that.
And so then it sounds like you're not at this point anticipating cutting any services in the town.
I don't know. People, especially the people that moved here from larger cities, expect certain goods and services that we've never been able to provide. But the enterprise funds, water, sewer, and garbage, basically, are self-sustaining by user fees. So they're not part of the general fund. So those things can be offset by other taxes. I don't anticipating cutting anything, but just because we can't, we still have to maintain the parks, and as we increase in size, and yeah, you can't cut back. I mean, there's certain things that are not required, like plowing snow, filling potholes, spraying for mosquitoes, but I can guarantee you that's the first thing they come in and scream at you about. You know, basically for me, there's only three things a government does. It's infrastructure, quality of life, and economic development. So all those things rise and float together. And that's what we have to maintain. Because if we don't have any of those other things, we'd be dying off like some of these other towns or some of the other places in the West or Midwest or wherever where the towns are drying up. So I don't anticipate it at this point.
Supposing, for instance, that this ballot initiative passes and property tax is cut further, the 50% reduction to property tax across the board. I mean, at that point, that could get pretty serious, even for someone in your position, right?
The 50% one is probably the worst idea, the acquisition tax, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, that would be devastating. And you can't just consider the towns. You got to realize that that will affect the fire districts. And see, most small municipalities are not part of the fire district, but they support the fire district, which protects them. For example, the Tongue River Fire District for us, we don't pay any mill levies into them. And then they, I think they, fire districts get, at least our local one gets like 3 mills off of property tax, which is almost always agricultural. So they don't have much money to begin with. You start cutting that part of it, they're going to be hurting as far as maintaining their equipment and stuff. You know, one of the other things that like property taxes, we save for the future. And if we have no means of getting any savings, then, you know, we have to go out and borrow. Right now, we haven't had to borrow money for our projects. We've been able to fund them through the funds we set aside.
Could you lay out for me the potential downsides in having to borrow for projects like that?
Do you like paying interest on things?
No.
Do you like to make interest on things?
Yeah.
So it's a difference between having... drawing interest on investments or savings as opposed to paying out interest on things that we couldn't buy. 0% is great if you can get it, but you're paying out taxpayers' money when you can actually save money and not have to pay.
And then a follow-up on that, even though the 25% cut is not a substantial hit to you at this point, are you saying that one outcome from it could be that you're not able to put as much away in savings for the town?
That's a possibility, but that's, like I say, it's 11% of our general fund and 18% of our government revenues. So it contributes to that over, because it's really, you know, municipal governments in the state of Wyoming are so heavily dependent on taxes we do not generate locally that are given to us by the state. They go down to the state and they come back after the cut. So, you know, 64% of my general fund is taxes that are coming that we have no control over. So what we'd do is we would have to, you know, we just put less and less, but less into savings at any one given time, or less into investments, or the type of investments we're allowed to use.
So then what can the legislature do better to support towns like Ranchester now that the tax cuts are in effect?
I think they need to do a comprehensive tax bill. They need to look at the goods and services that are not taxed and spread the wealth, spread the pain around. At a forum for the chamber here, I did ask Senator Biteman, I said, you know, are you going to get rid of some of these exemptions that are out there? And his basic response was, well, no, that would make people unhappy. Then he turns around and says he's going to add another tax exemption. You know, every time they say we're going to cut tax exemptions, they go down and add two instead of, you know, they always talk about for every law we pass, we should eliminate two, but that's just not work for the tax exemption. There's money out there. It just needs to be looked at in a different way. So it needs to be comprehensive across the boards, all taxes.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today, Mayor. I appreciate it.
Thank you for considering Ranchester.
That was Ranchester Mayor Peter Clark talking with Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements on tax cut impacts. The Colorado River is used by nearly 40 million people and a massive agriculture industry. Oftentimes, all that demand doesn't leave much water behind for the river itself. One Native American tribe is trying to change that by giving the Colorado River the same legal rights as a person. By way of the Mountain West News Bureau, Alex Hager has more.
In far western Arizona, the barren brown desert sprawls across hundreds of miles, except right here, where the Colorado River creates a thriving pocket of green. Dylan Esquera, a member of the Colorado River Indian Tribes, says people here have a personal relationship with the water.
When you grow up along the river, you know, your identity is tied to that. You know, your culture is tied to that. You know, your past, your history is tied to it. You know, we look at it as something that nurtures us, so we have to protect it.
And now the tribal government is turning those values into law. It's in the process of giving the river the same rights a person would have in court, the first of their kind on the Colorado.
It can show proof that this is what you believe in, this is what you stand for.
Tribal Chairwoman Amelia Flores says these protections are critical now. Arizona is short on water. The fast-growing Phoenix area is already knocking on the tribe's door asking to buy or lease some. So these protections do two things. First, they send a message. They're a way to take millennia of indigenous values and write them into a newer colonial legal system.
We want to keep that essence alive as much as we can, and if it's the essence is in this Western way of thinking, then so be it.
Personhood status could also do something practical. The tribe wants to set up a fund for the river, so anyone coming to do business would have to pay toward habitat restoration or education for younger tribal members. Flores says it's a way to flip the script on how much of the Southwest uses water.
We've taken from this river. We're not giving back. We're not being reciprocal and giving back.
This idea isn't new. Flores learned about so-called rights of nature on a trip to New Zealand with the indigenous Maori people. With examples abroad and in the U.S., there are some lessons about how this might play out on the Colorado River. Erin O'Donnell teaches water law at the University of Melbourne in Australia.
Given that it is a river like the Colorado that has been the subject of so many lawsuits and has such a complicated legal framework and extends well outside the boundaries of the Colorado River Indian tribes, I think the backlash is a real issue that they will need to be aware of and navigate.
O'Donnell says making a river a legal individual is a double-edged sword. Companies or governments can push back by taking legal action against that river. But, she says,
the most successful examples of rights of nature around the world have been the ones that are Indigenous-led. They tend to be the ones that get less backlash.
How exactly these new tribal laws will shape the region's management of the river is yet to be seen. But Heather Tanana says it's a step in the right direction for a river that's stretched too thin.
What has happened to date hasn't really worked. The river is still in decline.
Tanana is a member of the Navajo Nation and a law professor at the University of Denver.
We're still over-allocating, over-using, and so turning to new ideas, new tools definitely should be explored. And rights of nature is one of those.
But as much as this legal concept might be a new tool, Dylan Esquera says it reflects long-standing ideas from members of the Colorado River Indian tribes.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, we've always looked at the river as a person. You know, it's an entity. It's what we rely on to survive.
And here, with the birds chirping and fish flitting under the water surface, he says you can feel how the river is breathing and living. In Parker, Arizona, I'm Alex Hager.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced by KUNC in Northern Colorado and supported by the Walton Family Foundation. Jackson is home to a brain disease research lab. We take a tour up next on Open Spaces.
I'm Anna Sale, host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money, and a devoted listener to Wyoming Public Radio. When I'm in Wyoming and listening to Wyoming Public Radio, it's like another way to realize how incredible the relationship you can have between a radio and a listener is, because Wyoming is so sparsely populated. Like, you are speaking to so many people who are spread out across this broad landscape, and you're having this interaction
I kind of think of it as similar to podcasting. Like you're putting your voice out there and you're not really knowing what's going on in someone's life, but they could be like totally isolated on their own little patch of land in this big state and feeling connected. I love like hearing people mention listening to Wyoming Public Radio when they're doing things, when they're just like out. It's them and the elements and Wyoming Public Radio, you know? So it's again a reminder of just how sacred that relationship between, you know, audio and a listener can be.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Camila Kadalska. When you think about brain disease research, you might not think about Wyoming. But in Jackson, across from a grocery store and a rafting company on Highway 89, a nonprofit lab is researching diseases like Alzheimer's and ALS. It's called Brain Chemistry Labs. The team there is from all around the world, England, Canada, Mexico. And the problems they're tackling actually have real implications for the state. Both diseases disproportionately impact older populations, and Wyoming's 65 and over age group is growing rapidly. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman stopped by the lab to hear about a blood test they're working on to help detect ALS. Senior research scientist Rachel Dunlop took her on a tour to see a day in the life of a brain scientist.
I've been here for nearly 10 years now, and my PhD was in cell biology, and obviously I don't have a Jackson accent. I'm from Sydney, Australia. The focus of my work here at the Brain Chemistry Labs is working on a diagnostic test to diagnose amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, sometimes known as Lou Gehrig's disease, in patients using a simple blood draw.
What are we looking at here on your desk?
Yeah, so Hannah, you're sitting at my lab bench here in our lab in Jackson. We have lots of different machines that you may be able to hear whirring and buzzing in the background. Here at my bench, we're working on a process called PCR, or polymerase chain reaction. And this is a process where you can amplify DNA many, many hundreds of times over, so you can actually image it. So it was also the technology that was used during COVID. Many of us would have had a COVID test where a swab was taken from the inside of our nose, and then that was run through a machine to tell you if you had COVID or you didn't have COVID. Well, these bank of machines here, those are those machines. They're called qPCR, or real-time polymerase chain reaction machines, and they can take the tiniest amount of a human sample and amplify it many times over so that we're able to sequence it and determine what it means for a patient. And so we receive blood samples here from many, many sources, primarily from the Centers for Disease Control. And with those, we're able to analyze whether somebody has ALS or doesn't have ALS using this technique called PCR.
I'm just curious, like, what drew you to this lab as someone who, you know, is not from Jackson, not from Wyoming, not from the US? What was the draw for you here?
Well, yeah, my expertise during my PhD was looking at age-related diseases, so heart disease specifically, and trying to figure out why proteins build up in people's arteries and they block the arteries, and that can lead to a heart attack or a stroke. And so I developed some precise techniques with my colleagues in Sydney to figure out why these proteins get sticky and build up and then don't get broken down. And so that also applies to some of our neurodegenerative diseases, where we get these proteins building up and they can cause the cells to die, and then that causes a chain reaction effect where cells that are adjacent to that also die, and that can lead to the breakdown of neurons and then people get sick. My training was in that, and then I was collaborating with Dr. Cox, who's our executive director here, and our colleagues here, and they eventually said, well, we're doing so much work together, why don't you just come here? And so that's when I came to Jackson.
What are some of the pros of working in a lab in a place like Jackson in Wyoming, and what are some of the complications that brings up?
I mean, you just have to look around outside here, and there are not many cons, I've got to say. But we do have some issues with the weather here in terms of getting consumables and supplies into our lab, because we get a lot of storms and we've got the mountains. So sometimes we'll have items that are stuck over in Idaho Falls for days and days because they can't get over the pass, you know, just like us actually, because I live over the pass. But this is such a special place. Jackson is such a special place in terms of the beauty and the wilderness. It's so incredible. And I find it really allows me to focus on my work a lot because I don't have many distractions in terms of, in a big university, there's lots of buzz and hubbub. We don't have that here, so we just come to work, we focus really hard, and we get really good outcomes.
Can we do a little tour of like what are some of these random bits and bobs?
We have lots of little trays here that contain tiny little tubes, which is where we put our samples in every day. We have lots of little centrifuges that make lots of sounds when you spin plates. So we'll take a plate that we put in a machine and we'll spin it in one of these. And that's to make sure the samples are sitting nice and flat in the plate and they don't have any bubbles in them, for example. And then we have another little tiny centrifuge here that we use for our little tubes to spin down our samples. So this has a thing in it called a rotor, which spins at 6,000 rotations per minute. And that will make sure that our samples are not stuck to the side of a tube. They get gently pushed down to the bottom of the tube so we don't miss anything when we're doing an experiment.
Can we go take a look at the robot?
Yeah, sure. The robot's just over here. This is actually a 3D printer that's kind of been hacked to be a liquid handling robot. And so it allows us to do all of our pipetting using a robot instead of a human, me. And I used to pipette all of these reactions, of which there are 384, by hand at my bench. And I started to go a little bit kooky because it was very hard to concentrate on it and I would make mistakes. And it means that there's no longer any human error involved in my experiments. And so this is fantastic for increasing the accuracy of our work and speeding up the process as well.
What are we watching happen right now?
Yeah, so you can kind of hear the little whirring noises as this is a pipette head that is moving between the special tips that go on the pipette, and it's picking up the samples from one plate. It's moving to my PCR plate where it's dispensing those samples. And then it's moving to another plate that has a special mix, like a recipe mix. It's like making a cake a little bit, Hannah. And then it puts that recipe mix into my PCR plate and mixes it up so that it's nice and homogenized. And then it does that for 384 times.
Will you tell me a little bit about sort of where this test is at in terms of its availability and who's using it, how people are using it?
So it can currently take up to 12 months for a patient to get diagnosed with ALS. And this, of course, leads to increased anxiety for them, but also it means people are not able to get onto drugs quickly. And the sooner you get treatment, the more likely it is to be effective. So our test can return a positive or negative result in as little as a few days. And this means patients can access treatments earlier when they're more effective. So right now, this test is not available for patients. We are a discovery lab and we are still in the development stages, but we have advanced so far with this test now that we really need the help of a diagnostic company to come help us commercialize it, because our primary goal is to get this into the hands of patients and physicians as soon as possible.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman touring Wyoming's Brain Lab with research scientist Rachel Dunlop. And we'll circle back to the state of journalism in the Cowboy State, a roundtable up next on Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Radio is looking for motivated listeners to volunteer with us. Spend your free time supporting your favorite public radio station. Just visit our website and click the volunteer button at the top to get started.
As we heard at the top of the show, we've been experiencing earthquakes this month in Wyoming's news ecosystem. So we thought it might be a good time to take the temperature of journalism across the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down for a conversation with Melissa Cassett. She directs the Wyoming Local News Fund, which recently released a study on Wyoming's news ecosystem. They're joined by Rod Miller, who is currently a digital news opinion columnist for WyoFile. He also wrote in the past for Cowboy State Daily, where he pushed back on the idea that Wyoming has a news desert.
Melissa, I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about the turbulence that we have been seeing in our news ecosystem over the last couple of weeks.
I'd spent a week in the winds on a horsepacking trip, and I come out to my phone dinging of like, Pinedale Roundup has closed. All these newspapers have closed. And I was like, oh no, this is not what we wanted. But it did sort of reinforce the vulnerabilities that we knew about in our ecosystem. We had counties that were served by one newsroom that was staffed by one person. And a lot of those counties were owned by one chain. And so were that chain to go out of business, all of these counties could go dark. And that's essentially what happened. Thankfully, who came in was a local owner. And so I think that's the best case scenario of what we could have had happen is a family that has longtime roots in Wyoming came in and picked up all those papers. It could have gone a completely different direction. And it happened so quickly.
Rod, what was your reaction when you heard that news?
The 8 local newspapers that closed their doors briefly were like one department of an offshore media conglomerate. And when the parent company went belly up, so did the 8 local newspapers. On their own, each of those local newspapers would be solvent. They have a solid subscriber base. They have advertisers who've been advertising with them for decades. So all the ingredients are there for a local newspaper. A statewide digital media like I work for, Wyofile, Cowboy State Daily, can't fill that gap. We can't put stringers in Lusk or Torrington or Kemmer. But those local communities deserve that kind of coverage. So I think the fact that the national conglomerate went up and Wyoming folks bought those 8 newspapers is maybe the best thing that could have happened to those 8 newspapers.
Melissa, so, you know, when you took a look at that survey, where do you feel like we stand as far as are we a news desert or not?
This is always one that I'm like, no, with a caveat. We have a local source in every county, but if you live in those counties where you have a local source, but it's one person who's working their tail off to try and cover an entire county by themselves, they cannot physically do it. And so if you live in that community, you are feeling what a local news desert feels like. We have vulnerabilities and we have places for improvement. And what we saw in the study was, while we have high trust still in our state of our local news, there's still dissatisfaction of what our local news is providing in some areas.
Rod, when you were over at Cowboy State Daily, you wrote an article that was called Wyoming is a News Desert with a Hell of a Lot of Rain.
It is, yeah. If what we're talking about are those local communities, and I'm thinking back to my days as a young man and a kid reading the Rollins Daily Times, which was a daily newspaper, and Rollins was probably, I don't know, 5,000 or 6,000 people then. There was a society page that said, you know, on such and such a day, Peg Miller hosted a tea at her house for 20 ladies, and she served, you know, lamb nuts and Everclear, and the talk was all about Bridge Club or something. And the heartbeat of that community was reading about what went on in town, in the newspaper. That cannot be replicated by a statewide organ like Casper Star, or in fact, the big statewide newspapers are the ones that are suffering from the proliferation of digital news, because a digital news organization does not have the capital requirements of a Casper Star. You need a big Heidelberg press and an office and da-da-da-da. That model can't be sustained today and produce a product that has meaning on the streets of Lusk or Kemmer. Can't do it. Local reporters, local editors can do that.
When I go and look at the news desert map, Idaho has 7 counties without papers. Utah has 6 without papers. Colorado has 7. Nebraska has 7. Montana has 3. We have 0. We have 0 counties without a paper. What was amazing to me was the reaction of our state. There's something about Wyomingites. We are valuing our local news in a way that our neighbors aren't. What do you guys think about that?
Wyoming people are pretty goddamn demanding in that respect. They don't like not knowing what's going on, and they'll let you know. God bless them.
I agree with that. And they're also, they're connected, you know, they want to be connected. They would like to have it continued, I don't know, historic tradition, either through a paper, through a radio station, through a way that it's been delivered in the past. And I think because they're so connected, they know the people who's producing the news. They don't feel disconnected from their newspapers, from their reporters.
We, I believe, tend to accept information more from people we know, our neighbors, you know, the reporters that we've met, the editors that, you know, drink whiskey with us at the bar. We may not agree with what they're telling us, but we respect that it comes from a reliable source. I think there's an ingrained suspicion of getting information from strangers.
I wonder if you guys can talk a little bit about what does a healthy way forward look like?
I would submit that in the history of journalism, there has never existed a monolithic, universally accepted, purely objective source of news. That has never happened. The smorgasbord seems to be the free market solution. You know, you go to a supermarket, you don't have just, you know, one brand of pasta available to you. News should be the same way. People should be able to have a source of their news and opinion, and I include the opinion page as the endocrine system of any newspaper. It pumps out our hormones. The consumer should have a range of options from which he or she can pick or choose for a news source that satisfies them. And that's the American way.
I do agree. The more media you have, the better off communities are. And the more it shrinks, the worse off the community tends to be. At some point, some of these communities had like 4 or 5 different options between different newspapers, alt weeklies, radio stations. And as we see digital outlets come online and different newsletters, social media channels, all those things contribute to what can be very vibrant discussion. Right now, as we were talking about news deserts, Wyoming has at least one local news source in every county, but one is a very low bar. And in many cases, that one is staffed by one person. We don't want to be clawing back from nothing, but the more we can have, the more vibrant our communities are going to be.
As you mentioned, some of these very small papers only have one person, which means that they don't have an editor. It like lowers that bar even farther when you don't have like a rigorous editorial process. A lot of the digital papers kind of tend to giving their readers or listeners what it is that they want. The media is constantly getting accused of bias. I really liked what the former dean of the journalism school here at University of Wyoming said, which was, the news media also does need to be able to give their readers a little oatmeal. They don't want to eat it, but they kind of need it. You know, sometimes that is our job. That was reinforced when I interviewed Jen Steve Hicks, who's just bought out these 8 papers that almost closed. She said the same thing, that sometimes our job in the media is to be leaders and to say the hard things, to make people uncomfortable. And so too much of the customer is always right can be problematic as well. So thoughts on that?
I write an opinion column. And I mentioned I consider the opinion page to be the genitalia of a news organization. I relish that. I love punching people's buttons and provoking them to think and presenting an alternative point of view that might make them run from the room like their hair's on fire. But they need to read it. They need to know those ideas are out there. And I think I'm pretty much covered by the First Amendment when I do that.
I agree with you that there is this balance of what the community wants to read about and what the community needs to know. We asked in our ecosystem study, you know, what topic areas are you most engaged in? I do think there's a component of answers people think they should give and what we know about what people actually click on. Because what they actually click on are stories about crime and stories that are headline grabbing. What they need at times are, this is happening in your county right now. This tax is going to be passed. Here's your opportunity to comment on it one way or the other. Your school board is doing this or your hospital board is doing this. You need to know about this before it's too late. Those are the sort of like part of your steady diet that you need to know about. And this is the role that your local media plays. So it was kind of interesting in the ecosystem study of what people said they want, and then comparing that to, as myself as a journalist and talking to other journalists, what we know people actually are clicking on. Yeah. And they also like the weather. That is always a top.
Especially in Wyoming, right?
Especially in Wyoming.
As the Buffalo Bulletin and Rob Mortimer start to get their hands around this giant project that they have taken on to manage all of these papers across the state, what advice might you offer them, or what hopes do you have for them?
I am hopeful that they use all their years of experience and wisdom to revitalize these publications and really give the communities back something that they've lost over the past several decades. These publications have been chipped away at.
The only advice I would offer Rob and his crew is more scratch and sniff centerfolds in the papers. But that probably only appeals to me. Beyond that, I don't have any advice to offer them. Those guys have been down this trail before. If I have any advice, it might be to the state of Wyoming. If, as we said, these local newspapers provide a valid civic benefit, perhaps the responsibility for maintaining that lies just not on the citizens of Lusk or Kemmer, but on the state as well, to make sure we have a well-informed citizenry. We might want to take a look at the state funding mechanism. By that, I do not mean the state owning a means of information, but I mean giving Rob and his folks access to like community development block grants, to maybe a state loan program that would help them raise the capital that it takes to make sure those papers get on the street.
Without an informed citizenry, without an informed public, it's really hard to be informed on anything else going on.
I can read the negative comments to the podcast now, you commies.
Send all your comments to Rod. He'll give you his direct email.
He'll tell you where to put them.
Well, thank you guys both so much.
Melissa, great to meet you. Thanks so much.
We've been speaking with Melissa Cassett, who is the founder of the Wyoming Local News Fund, and Rod Miller, who's a columnist for WyoFile and formerly with the Cowboy State Daily. Thank you both so much for joining me today.
What a pleasure. What a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, this episode's audio producer and digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.